News.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. The scenes are agonizingly familiar. The aerial views of buildings swarming with emergency vehicles and personnel, frantic family members arriving on the scene, press conferences with public officials delivering the disturbing details. Then in the days after, the candlelight vigils and heaps of flowers appearing as makeshift memorials. On Friday, we learned of perhaps the most horrifying mass shooting yet in terms of the defenselessness of the victims, 20 first graders shot and killed in their school, along with six staff members, including the principal, who reportedly lunged at the gunman in an effort to stop him. President Obama went to Newtown, Connecticut yesterday to offer what condolences he could.
We gather here in memory of 20 beautiful children and six remarkable adults. They lost their lives in a school that could have been any school, in a quiet town full of good and decent people that could be any town in America.
In the aftermath of these incidents, communities often ask, how could this happen here, in this quiet town? We'll discuss these and other questions, including how we explain these tragedies to our children and how we deal with them ourselves. And let's hear from you. What thoughts and feelings do you have coming out of this dreadful tragedy? Give us a call, the Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. You can post a comment on our Facebook page or on the Exchange page at nhpr.org. We have three guests with us for the hour. David Finkelhor is here, director of UNH's Crimes Against Children Research Center and a sociology professor at UNH. And David, thanks a lot for being with us. We really appreciate
Welcome.
It. Also with us, Donna Decker, professor of English at Franklin Pierce University, who teaches a course on school shootings. And Donna has a forthcoming book on a 1989 school shooting in Montreal, Canada. Donna, thank you also for taking the time.
Thank you, Laura.
And also with us, Tim Wildman, a pastoral psychotherapist based in Concord. And Tim, thank you also. I know this has all been very last minute, so thanks for being with us.
Sure.
Well, and Tim, to you first, you know, shock doesn't even begin to describe this. You can't even find the words. What's been your reaction, Tim, and the reaction that you've heard this weekend around the Granite State?
I think the word that's been used most often is numbness. That may be even better, more descriptive than shock, in the sense that emotions are so complicated and huge that it's almost as if a kind of wall forms in front of those to sort of dilute the impact of them, because everybody has been engaged by this, and it has felt to me, especially in church yesterday, a lot like it felt the first Sunday after 9/11, in the sense of everybody being so numbed by the horror of this.
Yeah, well, and Donna, familiar themes, so frustratingly familiar. Angry young man, lots of guns, violence, it's so frustratingly familiar, Donna, isn't it?
Absolutely. So much of what we've seen in the last few days is completely familiar in terms of the media presentation of what's happened, exactly what you just said, young men and guns and so on. And yet, what makes this different in such a poignant way is that little children were the victims this time.
So what do you think, David Finkelhor? You study crimes against children, not a very happy field of study, I have to say. How does this feel different, and how does it feel the same?
Well, there's a lot that we still don't know about this episode, and so I'm a little reluctant to do too much specific analysis, but we have learned a lot about these rampage shootings or mass shootings over the last 10, 15 years, and they do seem to be a product of a combination of things, including young men with psychological problems who are isolated and marginalized, who get engrossed in cultural scripts that glorify armed attacks, in situations where there are generally surveillance failures to kind of notice that something is going on, and who typically have access to guns and some familiarity with their usage. And that recipe does give us some ideas for places where we might be able to intervene and do a better job.
Yeah, can you talk about that too, Donna? What we've learned, you've been studying these mass shootings. I'm interested in your thoughts on what David has said about young men who get engaged, as you said, in cultural scripts aimed at violence, Donna, and what we've learned from these other incidents elsewhere.
Sure. What David's talking about is came out very famously in a book called Rampage by Catherine Newman and some other scholars, and what she comes up with is called, she calls it a constellation theory, but it's exactly those 5 points that David made. You know, the shooter perceives himself as marginalized, has psychosocial problems, and the, you know, among other things, of course, access to guns and failure to be noticed. But the cultural script is something that my class has been particularly interested in. And so what that means is, what kind of models are out there in the media, primarily in the media, for boys, boys, adolescents who have challenges, you know, how do I work out an issue? I'm having trouble with one of my friends. I'm having trouble on the field. How do I go about working out some of the difficulties I'm experiencing? And all too often, the models that are out there are big, bulked up men with guns who solve their problems by blowing each other's heads off. And that is just not really where we want to be.
Wow. Tim, what do you think? And I have another question for you, too, Tim.
Well, yeah, I in terms of how people get to these places, yeah, they're clearly people that are in some way vulnerable psychologically. And I agree. I think the models that are available are a huge problem in our culture. And I think that when people then suffer these losses, the sense of horror and shock then begins to turn to a sense of frustration and powerlessness and anger in the grief about how this can keep happening. So I think there's a lot to all of this.
Well, and Tim, I know you'll be talking with your clients for many weeks about this.
Yeah.
And, you know, we as human beings are always looking for the why, you know, why this happened. And we latch on to, you know, one thing or the other. Talk about that a little bit, Tim, if you could, please, how we're trying to find the why, even if there isn't one why.
Yeah, I think what makes us unique as creatures on the earth is our capacity to reflect and understand. And I also think that we've come to see more and more that we are, you know, we are creatures of the narrative. We're always trying to construct, you know, stories that make that will help us make sense of what's going on in our environments. And I think making meaning of our lives is something we do from when we start until when we finish. And these are some of the most hugely challenging kinds of events to construct narratives for that are constructive. And I'm sure that's going to be part of our national conversation, but also our individual conversations with each other going forward.
Yeah, it's really hard to construct a narrative
around
this one.
Yeah.
I want to really offer our listeners an opportunity to jump in today on this. I really want to open the phones and invite people to just share their thoughts and feelings. I know we're all thinking about this. So you can join us at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page or on the Exchange page at nhpr.org. Again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. And all of you, let's go first to Anna, calling from Granville, Vermont. Hi, Anna. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I had a few comments, and this is an issue that I've cared about for a number of years, and every time it comes back in the news, I'm just more and more frustrated and infuriated. And a few points that I think have been really well made the past few days, one was actually by Morgan Freeman, saying that, you know, we continually celebrate the gunmen and the people doing these things, and that we end up not celebrating the victims. And We know the names of the men who shot up Columbine and have done things in the past, and we don't know the names of the victims. And I think that's part of the problem, is that we end up you know, celebrating these people that are looking for that.
Anna, can I jump in? I really appreciate your point. When you say celebrate, I don't think anybody's celebrating
Adam Lanza. Sure, sure. I think inadvertently. I think, you're absolutely right. Inadvertently, I think maybe that's how they end up seeing it, is that, you know, the people are talking about them and giving them attention.
Yeah, I'll be famous.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Yeah, celebrate in a really perverse way. Absolutely.
Yeah. So too much attention on the shooters for you, Anna.
Absolutely.
And yet, Anna, what do you think about what Tim Wildman said? You know, we're trying to construct some kind of narrative so that we can figure this thing out. That's just human nature. So,
sure.
You know, it's kind of human nature to say, what made this person do this, and how can we help other people so that they don't make the same choice?
Yeah, I think it's a really hard line to toe because, of course, we want to try and figure it out to prevent it. But again, at the same time, not commit a lot of attention to it.
Sure.
And so I think redirecting and looking at the problem as a whole and not to one specific person, but looking at it as the issue of access to guns.
Anna, thanks a lot. Yeah, I want to pick up on your media comment to you, David Finkelhor. I hear her. You don't want to glorify what this person did, but people do criticize the media during this time. But then again, people are also watching and reading because they want to get their heads around who this person is, how the town is coping. So I hear Anna's point, but it's tough. It's a tough line to walk, isn't it, David?
Well, it is. I agree that the cultural scripts that glorify violence play a role. But of the five factors that I think that Newman emphasized, my view is that the three that are probably easiest to deal with are kind of recognizing and treating the psychological problems, reducing the marginalization and isolation of young people, kind of doing better in terms of surveillance, and maybe doing something about gun access. I do think that the cultural scripts are probably of that list the hardest thing to change very quickly.
All right, Anna, thank you so much. And we will talk a lot more after a short break and take a lot more of your calls. So keep it right here.
Good morning, it's 9:19, and more of The Exchange coming up on NHPR at 10 on The Diane Rehm Show, mass shootings and their effect on the American psyche. New Hampshire weather, we have a winter storm warning in effect for central and northern New Hampshire, winter weather advisory in effect for southern New Hampshire. Today, snow changing to sleet, then eventually freezing rain in northern and central New Hampshire, an additional 2 to 4 inches possible, especially north of the White Mountains, highs near 30. Southern New Hampshire will have freezing rain changing to rain by early afternoon, temperatures rising to around 40 degrees. Support for NHPR comes from UR members, and support also comes to us from Lars Heating Systems, manufacturing boilers and water heaters for homes and commercial buildings for over 60 years, built in New Hampshire with pride, LARS.com. And the Dairy Field School, a 6th to 12th grade day school, inspiring students to find their passion for academics, athletics, and more. Open house January 3rd, dairyfield.org/visit. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tough topic today in The Exchange. We're getting your thoughts and feelings on the school shootings in Connecticut on Friday. We want to hear from you as we all pondered this subject over the weekend. Our number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page or on the Exchange page at nhpr.org. We have three guests with us: David Finkelhor, director of UNH's Crimes Against Children Research Center and a professor of sociology at UNH; Donna Decker, professor of English at Franklin Pierce University. She teaches a course on school shootings and has a forthcoming book out on a 1989 incident in Montreal, Canada. Also with us, Tim Wildman, a pastoral psychotherapist based in Concord. And again, we welcome your thoughts this morning, 1-800-892-6477. And folks, just before the break, Anna called in and David talked about her point. Frustration with media coverage of this, too much attention on the shooter, not enough on the victims. Boy, Tim, what do you think about this? It is really hard for the media to get it right. I'm not really sure what else to say except to ask what you think.
Well, I also think probably to some degree there is some respect for the victims and their families, and therefore maybe there isn't as much focused, at least after the initial incidents go by, as much focused on families. And yet, of course, the journey of loss that began on Friday is going to go on for forever for many of those folks. And so it's true that in the public consciousness we don't follow those stories, and yet I guess there may be some reasons that, out of respect, that perhaps we don't. But occasionally people will, you know, survivors, family members will make their stories more public as a way to try to change things, and that's always such an incredible, courageous thing that people do, because as I know from the work I do, the pain that people have after the trauma and the violence, the loss, particularly of children, it's overwhelming, and yet sometimes people do give us a window into the lives and feelings of those who survived.
You know, Tim, could you also just talk about secondary trauma? I mean, even people who have no connection to those families in Connecticut, you know, we're all feeling it.
Right. I sometimes early in my own work, it sort of felt to me like we all have an underground well of grief, sort of like an oil well would be, and when there's a tap into it of anything, we sort of tap into all our own personal, most difficult personal losses. And for some people who have trauma in their own background and have traumatic losses, something like this can really trigger a lot of those experiences of trauma and of their own grief, and can really set them back. So I think that's important to remember, that we're all walking around with folks who are undoubtedly had some of their own stories triggered by this.
Right. All right. All of you, I really want to go back to our audience now. And Margot is calling from Petersham, Massachusetts. Hi, Margot. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Two things. One, really minor. The Morgan Freeman quote that has been really in social media all weekend was shown to be a hoax. He actually never made that quote or made that statement to any kind of public media source. So just kind of another example of media going crazy. But I work in mental health, and my other point is kind of one that your guest already said, that, you know, it is important to get treatment and appropriate care for anyone with any kind of mental illness, but the access to guns is really the point that it becomes dangerous or not dangerous, you know, effective or not effective. And I feel like that cannot be stressed enough, that access to these dangerous weapons that, you know, maybe it's a personal opinion, just don't have any place in our general population, is what makes it become a dangerous, deadly situation.
So given that you work in the mental health field, Margot, I know a lot of people have focused on the guns, but I have heard a lot of people say, you know, it's not just about the guns, because plenty of people have guns and they don't do things like this. So
yep.
I just wonder what your thoughts are around that.
I think that plenty of people do have guns that aren't, you know, that aren't mentally ill or that treat them responsibly. But I guess my thoughts about it are, if assault weapons are in the mix, whether they're owned by a responsible, stable individual or not, if they're in the mix, if they're out there for people to get access to, they will. They will get access to them, because there are no guarantees about people who are mentally unstable.
Okay. Margot, thanks a lot for chiming in this morning. Appreciate
it. Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye. Again, our number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You know what's interesting? And I think I'll turn to you, David Finkelhor. Her comment about social media, too. I mean, I know it seems like an aside, but there has been a lot on social media about this. Some stuff, as she said, that's not even true.
And there's kind of a narrative that somehow social media has contributed to the problem by making access to some of these scripts more, you know, easier. I don't think we have any real evidence of that. I was going to make the point that I think in response to an earlier comment that one way in which I think the media and all of us can take some solace in this situation is to remind ourselves of the progress we have made. It's not like things are just going to hell in a handbasket. And homicide rates and suicide rates among young people have been declining over the last 20 years. We have much better access to mental health care than was true before. We're doing a better job of catching plotters in early stages of planning so that, for example, the number of children murdered in schools has actually declined.
Okay, that's pretty hard to hear at this point, David. I mean, really? We feel like feels like these things are happening all the time. President Obama said that this is the fourth, now not just schools, but fourth mass shooting that he has had to attend to as president. So I don't think folks are feeling a lot safer,
well,
David.
There has been an increase. There has been an uptick in mass shootings over the last 5 or 8 years. So that is true. But at the same time, the overall homicide rate is down over 50% since 1992. And I also like to refer people to a wonderful book by Steven Pinker called Better Angels of Our Nature, which is an account about how violence has been declining in our world over the millennia. And he cites some very interesting data showing that if you were a man in the Stone Age, you had about a 40% chance of dying as a result of violence. That although we are very aware of the amount of violence in our world because of the media, that is to some extent part of our new sensitivity to this issue and our effort to deal with it.
Let's take another call, all of you. And Jane is calling from Amesbury, Mass. Hi, Jane. You're on the air. Welcome.
Thanks. I guess the only other issue that I have thought about over and over, like we all have this these last few days, I'd like to see some gun control. I don't care if some say it'll never work. It's like ignoring a DUI on the road. You know, we do have to do something. And I'd like to see assault weapons banned. No, it won't take it out of the hands of everybody. We've got to try.
What else, Jane? What else is on your mind today?
Mental health. We don't, when I was a student in nursing, not to say they were right, but we had huge state hospitals everywhere. And I thought when they closed those, what are they going to do with all of those kids? And there were a lot of kids in them. We need to treat that.
Mental health resources.
Yeah. We have ignored it, and I think it's young men, and they need a place to go.
Well, Jane, thanks a lot. And Tim Wildman, you're a mental health professional. I'm wondering what you think today. I mean, we do hear so much about mental health services being cut back, very few for low-income people. Insurance companies don't want to cover it anymore because it's squishy. You know, it's not as easy to see as a broken leg.
Yeah, I think they're the picture to go back to David's point about violence a moment ago. I think there the picture is mixed. You can undoubtedly point to parts of the mental health treatment picture, which over the course of the last few decades have increased in terms of access to mental health services, in terms of at least shorter-term treatment being covered on an outpatient basis. But I also think that a lot of that sort of depends on where you live and what your awareness and access of mental health services are culturally and what the attitudes toward them are. And I know in my organization, the small organization I'm part of from around the country, a lot of my colleagues from other parts of the country are in places where people don't culturally accept going to mental health treatment services, and so I think there's still a long way to go in terms of being able to improve the potential for treatment that someone like this fellow could have received.
Yeah, and I have a couple of emails that I want to share with you. Did you want to jump in super quick, David?
I was saying making mental health services more accessible in schools and in the home, I think will allow some people to get it who haven't gotten it previously.
Well, and here's a couple emails that have come in. And I want to thank everybody, by the way, who's calling and emailing and so forth. This is Anne in Keene. She says, I don't think access to guns is the real issue, but rather the lack of access to effective and long-term mental health services in this country. Since the 1980s, residential treatment facilities have been closed. The trend has been to treat everything with medication only, as quickly as possible. And thanks for that email. And Tim, I think you addressed that somewhat in your answer to my last question. Here's another one from Mark. He says, I am a gun owner who believes in gun laws. I do acknowledge that there are some very weak areas in these laws. We do need to look at ease of access, these people getting to guns. But, Mark asks, is anyone looking at what role today's video games are playing in a person's mindset and their ability to separate fantasy from reality? Donna, what do you think? I'm sure this has come up in the school shootings that you have studied.
Oh, absolutely. studies indicate that violent video games do not, there's not a straight trajectory to violence. That's what the reputable studies indicate. However, it's such a difficult thing, and I think it plays into the whole cultural script that we're talking about. You know, this sort of focus on killing and shooting and so on. And many school shooters have been known to play video games. But then again, what young teenage boy do you know who doesn't? You know, I wanted to talk about mental illness, though. I'm getting really concerned with a lot of the discussion that seems to be stigmatizing mental illness. Mental illness, of course, all mental illnesses are not alike. And one of the concerns my students in my first year seminar on school shootings had was what high school boy is going to readily access whatever kinds of mental health resources there are. What boys are taught, this is a broad brush kind of statement I'll make, but what they're taught is to not share their feelings. The kinds of feelings that are okay for boys to share are anger and rage. If they are having some trouble and are feeling some sort of sadness or remorse, where is the option for them to, you know, to actually access that outlet without some sort of shunning going on from their peers? That was a big concern of my students, and it's a concern of mine. Eric Harris, the Columbine shooter, he played the system. He was in a juvenile justice program, came out with glowing colors. They let him out early,
wow.
And then he shot up the school.
Well, and since this did happen at a school, and again, just devastating, I do have now on the phone Mark Joyce. He is president, head of the New Hampshire School Administrators Association, which represents school superintendents, other school leaders. And Mark, thank you very much for giving us your time this morning.
My pleasure, Laura.
Well, I have to ask you the broad question. I mean, since this happened at a school, what thoughts went through your mind? I mean, I'm sure you had personal pain for the families involved, but also professional concern.
Well, Laura, I think on behalf of all educators, our thoughts and prayers go out to all the people impacted by this event. And we can reassure folks that educators have forever been concerned about the safety of students, employees, and guests at school. And I think in light of recent events, have become even more vigilant.
Even more vigilant. So it sounds so silly, but should parents worry? Because a lot of us are feeling worried.
We've been asked that question, and school leaders met this weekend, had conference calls, communicated with their parents, citizens, and staff. But my personal belief is that schools are among the safest places for children. Not only are the schools strive to keep all doors locked and entrances monitored, but children are surrounded by adults who care for them and who've been trained how to respond. As a parent and a grandparent, I would not hesitate to send my child to their school.
What do you think is going to change, Mark, at New Hampshire schools as a result of this, if anything?
Well, certainly a tragic event like this heightens everyone's awareness. As you may know, schools are required to have emergency management plans, to actually practice those in the course of the year. Some of those involve actually an intruder in the building or a shooter in the building. They're coordinated with the local law enforcement. They follow a state model. So I think obviously folks are going to perhaps redrill that plan in light of this event.
Yeah.
And help people, just become ever more vigilant.
My third grader just last week had another practice session, and he told us about it. And it was very matter of fact for him, Mark. It wasn't anything scary. It was just that's what we do. And yet, I got to say, Mark, when I go to my kids' schools, you know, I have to buzz to get in, but nobody stops me. I just walk right in.
Well, Laura, you're a pretty famous person, well, so maybe that accounts for that.
But I don't know.
I know from personal experience this year, we've done studies in 11 different schools, and part of our study is to actually check that. And so not only did we need to be buzzed in, but adults throughout the building, if they did not know you, very politely challenged, may I help you, and why are you here? So that is something that over my 40 years has changed very much, and school staff are heightened to that. You know, it is such a tragic event. All of our nerves and our feelings are so raw at this point. And again, school leaders and teachers are very sensitive today to being able to work well with kids and their families to try to rebuild that sense of security.
What do you recommend that teachers say to their kids this morning, Mark?
Well, you know, you have trained mental health experts on the show, but one of the things that we cooperated with was the State Department of Emergency Management shared talking points from Health and Human Service and other state agencies to school superintendents and system leaders. They in turn shared them with staff over the weekend. My son happens to be a teacher, and he received a personal message from the superintendent with recommended practices.
Okay. And so Mark, I got to cut you off there. I do apologize.
My pleasure, Laura.
Yeah, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. Have a great day.
All right. Mark Joyce, head of the New Hampshire School Administrators Association. A lot more of your thoughts coming up. Stay with us.
This is NHPR, where support comes from you, our members, and Courier Museum of Art in Manchester, presenting Printmaking in the Age of Rembrandt, featuring prints by Rembrandt and his contemporaries from the Dutch Golden Age, courier.org. And from BAE Systems, on behalf of its employees, remembering our troops this holiday season. Happy holidays from BAE Systems. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is Betsy Gardella, president of NHPR. Thank you to everyone who supported us during the winter fundraiser. But upon learning about the horrific school shooting in Connecticut, we have canceled the drive. Our hearts go out to the many families affected by this tragedy. NHPR will cover the story as it unfolds in the days and weeks to come. Thank you all so very much.
And this is The Exchange here on NHPR. We're following up on the shootings in Newtown, Connecticut, getting thoughts, feelings, reactions around the Granite State. And, of course, we want to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. We have three guests, Donna Decker, professor of English at Franklin Pierce University, who teaches a course on school shootings and has a forthcoming book on a 1989 incident in Montreal, David Finkelhor, director of UNH's Crimes Against Children Research Center, and Tim Wildman, pastoral psychotherapist based in Concord. And I wanted to ask, I think you, David, about this idea of how we assess risk. Mark Joyce was telling us school is very safe. As a parent and grandparent, he would send his kids to school. 99.9% of planes don't crash, David, but, you know, when one does, we sort of put ourselves there. What do you think about our ability to effectively assess risk?
Well, we're extremely sensitive to these very high-profile situations, and it does miscalibrate our sense of danger, and it's something that we have to guard against. particularly when we go to make policy and when we think about the welfare of our own kids. Because as he said, schools are extremely safe places, probably safer than their own families or on the streets. Only 2% of child homicides occur in schools, and those are mostly middle and high school age kids. The main risk for particularly young kids is at the hands of their own family members. 700 kids die every year from parental assaults. Another 700 die as a result of parental negligence. If we're going to be concerned about the safety of kids, we really have to prioritize those kinds of problems, not at the expense of school safety, but we shouldn't just suddenly throw all of our resources into preventing the school shooter when there are all these other children who are at risk from known kinds of situations that we actually, I think, have a lot of resources to try and prevent.
Yeah, and we've talked about this before in terms of sexual assault. We always think it's the rapist waiting in the dark alley when really it's much more likely to be a family member, at least when it comes to sexual crimes against children. I want to go back to our listeners, and Stan is waiting in Whitefield. Hi, Stan. Thanks for being with us on The Exchange.
Thank you very much.
Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I'm a gun dealer, and I'm in Whitefield. And people, I don't know if people realize, every gun sold by a dealer, is the individual has to fill out a federal form and a questionnaire, and then we call either the FBI or the Concord State Police to do a background check on that individual. On the form, there is a question that deals with mental health, and it specifically asks if the applicant has ever been committed to a mental institution. Now, the applicant will always answer no.
Right.
However, there is absolutely no way we can check on mental health records. The federal system will not access mental health records. They're protected by HIPAA. So you could, and literally several years ago, I had an incident where someone was on a weekend leave from an institution and purchased a gun for me. The gun was returned the next day by the man's wife. There are no checks on mental records done during the purchase of a firearm in this country. So the question is, can that be done in spite of HIPAA? Should that be done? And what criteria would be used for the disqualification of a purchase based on a person's mental health background?
Wow, yeah, that's a tough one, Stan, huh? I can see both sides of that one, right? I mean, digging into somebody's mental health record.
It's very difficult. It's protected. But as a dealer, you know, we want to sell responsibly, obviously. We don't want to see guns fall into the hands of people who shouldn't own them. But we have no way of checking mental health records.
Wow. Well, Stan, thank you very much. Yeah. Who wants to jump in on that one?
Can I talk about the bystander issue here? I think something we haven't talked about, and one of the things that has been discovered in a number of these, particularly school shooting episodes, is that there often are bystanders, persons who have some knowledge about the activities of the planner or who are aware of the fact that somebody is decompensating and having these kinds of fantasies. And we could do a lot more to mobilize these people to get help, to notify authorities. And I think that's one of the things actually we're doing better in the school environment. But it also applies to the gun purchase thing. As in the example that this dealer just gave, there was somebody else in that household who recognized that somebody who had acquired guns or had access to guns might misuse them and took some action.
You know, can I, this is a tough one, Stan. I'm glad you called. Donna, I mean, has anybody looked at this idea of, you know, a lot of these shooters do have mental health issues, and could someone make a case for opening up the mental health records when someone tries to buy a firearm? It's a tough issue Stan raises. Thanks a lot, Stan.
That is. I mean, the fact is that most school shooters are not diagnosed with a mental illness before the shooting. And some of them, you know, again, it goes back to mental illness. All mental illness isn't equal. And so Stan is saying they can't access the records, and the records he suggested that could potentially be accessed would be, has somebody been institutionalized? Most of the school shooters that I've studied have not been institutionalized. The one who stands out as different from that is Sung Hui Cho, who did the killings at Virginia Tech. And there was a long, such a long path of trying to get this kid help.
Yeah.
And it did not stop anything. He was institutionalized for a while. It didn't matter.
so often goes unnoticed kind of raises in my mind what, Donna, what David just said, you know, the bystander issue, not bystander to a crime, but someone who knows the person, suspects they may be having some issues. Maybe these people need to step it up.
I think if there's any hope, I don't mean to sound so bleak, but I think that's a real key that David's bringing up, the bystanders. And that seems to be a bit of a change in that some school shootings, just one last week, was thwarted because somebody tipped off the police. There was in Batesville, Oklahoma, a student actually had a plan very much like a novel called We Need to Talk About Kevin by Lionel Shriver. And in that novel, the student killer lured students into a gymnasium, chained the doors closed, and killed them. And that was the exact plot of this student in Batesville, Oklahoma. But somebody ratted him out, if you will, and so he was caught. The same thing in August of 11 in Tampa, Florida. A student had a very serious arsenal of weapons and bombs and would have done catastrophic damage. And yet he was thwarted because someone called. So bystanders are completely essential to this.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for that call again, Stan. And let's take another one. This is Nick in Milford. Hi, Nick. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Hi, Laura. How are you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've noticed that when tragedies like this happen, there's always immediately a lot of blowback to restrict guns, restrict video games, and things like that. But there's plenty of people out there who know how to use these products responsibly, even people with mental illnesses. I suffer from anxiety and depression. I own guns, and I play video games, and I function just fine. And there's plenty of people out there who are the same way. And if there's people out there who can't, personally, I feel a little bit better knowing that there's, you know, good people out there who are carrying, who, you know how to properly use their firearms for self-defense.
So a little too easy, Nick, to say that if you've got guns and you play violent video games and maybe you've had some mental health issues, still too easy to put that package together? Is that what you're saying?
I just feel people are always really quick to point the finger at somebody, and those are the two that get hit the most. But there's a lot of different things that need to be factored in.
Thank you, Nick, for calling in. Donna, what do you think? A little too easy and convenient to say this is it.
Sure. I mean, isn't that what we want? Tim said that we are creatures of the narrative, and that's what we are. We want to be able to tell ourselves a story wherein we are not part of this tragedy, where our children are safe because something we can identify is not in our life, if that makes sense. So, you know, somebody with some sort of mental illness or, you know, has all kinds of weapons, well, we don't have that in our town or our schools are safer. We need to find a way to separate ourselves from this kind of tragedy. And so we create narratives. And famously, Dave Cullen, who wrote Columbine, deconstructed all of the myths that were posited by the media initially after Columbine. And they were one by one dismissed as untrue. And we've seen that. We've seen that in the last few days. The patterns are there. What do we hear about this killer? He was remote and quiet and not social. Completely predictable. He was brilliant. Completely predictable. He was a goth. Completely predictable. You know, we don't know yet if any of those are true, but the fact is that we put these things out in order that we separate ourselves and make ourselves safe.
There's a lot of emails that have come in, and I can't share all of them with you, but I would like to share a couple. This is from David, who says, last Friday, in addition to the Newtown attack, 22 children were attacked in China by a man with a knife. This appears to have been conveniently left out of the debate on the role of guns in this tragedy. And David actually sent along a link to a BBC article. Now, the China school knife attack injured 22 children too seriously. Didn't kill them, but I appreciate you sending us the email, David. Here's one from Forrest. He says, I think it is important to emphasize that the perpetrators of these massacres are almost exclusively male. Thus, this is not a human problem. This is a male problem. And while your guests have said we have better access to mental health services, my experience as a psychotherapist and coordinator of sexual violence prevention at Keene State College is that community mental health services in New Hampshire and nationally have been decimated over the past couple of decades. And Forrest, thanks for that email. And Tim Wildman, we talked earlier about lack of access to mental health services. So we've sort of dealt with that. What about his first point, though? This is a male problem.
Yeah, certainly you can see by looking at all of the shooters from all these incidents that that's true. Donna was talking a little bit earlier about, in a broad brush kind of way, I think she said about the acculturation of males from childhood on. People have been writing about this for a while now. One of the books that comes to mind, although there are many, is Terrence Reel's I Don't Want to Talk About It on Male Depression, written a while back now. But there's been lots of writing about how it is that traditionally boys are raised to detach themselves from their feelings, especially their vulnerable feelings. I think that's the point. It's the reason that anger and is all right, in quotes, is because it's not a vulnerable feeling. It's a secondary feeling. After you felt vulnerable, you felt fear, you felt sadness, you felt exposure in some way, you felt shame. The defense against that is usually some form of aggression, and so I think we do have to. And I think in some quarters we've been at this long enough now that you can see in schools and with teachers and with parents that boys and girls are now being raised more similarly than they used to be. Certainly, I can see that in my own lifetime. But I do think that that's part of the issue, although you can't make it simplistic in that way. But I do think that the various encouragements toward an aggressive solution is much more a male solution. The other thing I wanted to say is about I do think it's important that the level of violence in speech, whether it's on the internet or even to some degree on television and the media, I believe that I've seen just in my own practice that people can become more complacent about the kinds of things that they might be seeing in their own households or in their own networks that could be danger signs, because it's sort of taken for granted that everybody speaks like this, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, so...
I've been on the mail issue.
Yeah, go ahead, David. Thanks. Yeah.
Just a couple of points. One of the things that's changed is that we have psychiatric medications now that are much more acceptable to men as a form of treatment than talk psychotherapy, and they've been shown to be very effective and may be one of the reasons why overall violence has declined over the last 20 years since they've been introduced. But I do think that there are other things that we can do, knowing that the problem is primarily among boys and males. One is that we can provide activities in schools that reduce their marginalization and isolation among those who don't fit in, things besides athletics where they can excel, kind of ways of drawing them into group activities that mitigate the isolation.
Yeah, you know,
secondly,
it's interesting.
Talk about the help that we provide in other terms, you know, talk about it with the coaching metaphor or the life skills metaphor, rather than as a therapy. Which
okay, and David, I got to cut you off there. I do apologize, but got just about a minute left, and I really want to hear from at least one more listener. John's in Laconia. Hi, John. Thanks for hanging on.
Yes, hi. Good morning, Laura. I appreciate you taking my call.
Sure.
One of the best, well, first of all, my heartfelt condolences out to all the families and friends of the families of the victims of this tragedy. And one of the best things that I read over the weekend was a quote from a grandmother, how she explained to her grandson how to deal with seeing this kind of horrible stuff on the news. And what she told him was, look for the heroes. And that was just so profound for me. And I think it's to some degree comforting for all of us if we do that. And then also perhaps there's a little chance that if the media and people are in the conversation about looking for the heroes, that the next potential shooter or, you know, violent person could perhaps, you know, be looking up to that as a hero as opposed to the macho man. And, you know, that might provide something.
Wow. So idolizing the principal who threw his body in the line of fire to protect children, and glorifying that instead of all the attention on the shooter. Her body, I do apologize. Yeah.
Right. Well, and everybody that was the hero in the situation, yes.
Yeah. Wow. Thank you so much, John, for giving us that and for going out on that somewhat positive note, although there's very little to be found that's positive in this whole thing. Thanks a lot, John. I really appreciate it. And all of you, I want to thank you for taking the time to be with us. And I'm sure as this conversation continues, you know, we'll be talking with you again. So much to dig into here. But thank you very much for being with us. David Finkelhor, thanks a lot.
You're very welcome.
David Finkelhor, director of UNH's Crimes Against Children Research Center. Donna Decker, thank you also for your time.
Thank you, Laura.
Donna Decker, professor of English at Franklin Pierce University, and has a forthcoming book on a 1989 shooting in Montreal. And Tim Wildman, thanks again for giving us your time. You've been real generous.
Sure. Blessings on all.
Tim Wildman, pastoral psychotherapist based in Concord. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern is Samantha Johnson. Our theme music is composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
Every weekday at 9 a.m., The Exchange examines the issues that concern you. The ones you talk about around the water cooler or at the breakfast table. Our focus is the news of the day, be it politics, education, or the environment. We bring you conversations about events half a world away or just down the street. I'm Laura Kanoy. Join me for The Exchange, weekday mornings at 9 on NHPR.
The Diane Rehm Show.